With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, welcome to the Writer's Routine podcast. This is where we get tips and advice from successful creative people by taking a look at the secrets of their working day. We find out actually how they get stuff done. Today, we are chatting to the screenwriter and now author, Paul A. Mendelsohn. He's talking about releasing his debut adults and kids book in the same year, been very busy. We'll also find out what it was like for him writing one of the biggest primetime BBC sitcoms, and we'll hear about the biggest secret that he learned while working on his first novel.
Don't get it right, get it written. And so the first time you put something down on paper, you sort of splurge it out. I think in America, sometimes they call it the vomit draft. And then you go over it and try and get it to the best shape you can.
So stay right there. It's all on the way on this week's Writer's Routine. Yes, welcome along then. My name is Dan Simpson. Thank you so much for giving us a download and giving us a listen as well. We're around 10 episodes into the Writer's Routine now. And if you've been with us the whole way through, and if you've learned anything from the show about ways to improve your own writing, well, I've got a way that you can test it out. And you can help both of us out. Why don't you get out your phone, your iPad, your tablet, whatever you want. Get onto your laptop too. And get onto the iTunes podcast store. And use your vastly improved writing style to leave this show a review. That's what you need to do. Find us on the podcast store, Writer's Routine. And if you could leave some lovely things about the show, that would be amazing. Also, 5 stars, that is 5 stars, goes a long way as well. Also, leave your name in there as well. So I know that you're there. I know that you're listening. Maybe I'll say hello on next week's show as well. That's what you can do to really help. Get to the iTunes podcast store and leave Writer's Routine a review. Our guest on the show this week, it's Paul A. Mendelsohn. He is an author, he's a scriptwriter, and he's a creative who's been pretty successful doing it as well. He was in charge of one of the biggest BBC primetime sitcoms in his time as well. We'll talk a bit more about that in a sec. Now, he's released his debut kids and adult books in the same year. He's been a busy guy. Do you remember the TV show My Hero? You remember Ardlo Hanlon, you know, he was the superhero in that, wore the red and yellow suit. Hugh Dennis, I think, cropped up as the really slimy, worm-like Dr. Piers. And you remember Ardlo and his brother from New York? They did that alien handshake and the catchphrase thing. I think it was zeet, znat, zeet. Yeah, that. Well, Paul Mendelsohn, he wrote that show. He invented the whole thing. So we'll talk about that in the chat too, because I'm really interested in moving from screenwriting and being in charge of a huge BBC show, as it was at the time, to then sitting by yourself in a cafe writing a book. And there's quite a lot of cafe chat in this talk. Also, our distinguished diary today, it features the weird and wonderful writing routine of one of the most eccentric writers in history, and one of the books that he wrote as well inspired one of the 20th century's biggest films. That's on the way after our chat then. The meat of the show, let's get into it. Finding out the writer's routine of Paul A. Mendelsohn.
What I usually see in front of me when I write is the rest of Costa Coffee and Pinner. I write at home as well, but I've always written in cafes because writing is essentially quite a lonely business. And when you work in cafes, at least you get some sort of semblance of people around you and people chat. And because it's in my local area, people I know come in. And as long as you don't listen too carefully to the conversation going on at the next table, you can actually get on with quite a lot of work. So what I'm looking at is Chiara and Tonya and the people, the lovely people who work at Costa Coffee and Pinner.
Your debut adult novel was released at the start of the year. It's In the Matter of Isabel. Talk me through your average day when you were working on that book, from the moment that you woke up to the moment you went to bed.
From the moment that I woke up, I would do a walk from my house, possibly round to the centre of Pinner where I live, or I might walk up to, there's a golf course nearby where there's some lovely greenery, and you can go so high that actually from there you can even see the Shard in Wembley Stadium, so that's quite nice. Then I'll walk down into Pinner, and I'll sit down at the cafe, and I'll get my little iPad out, and I will start to write, and I'd give myself probably a certain number of words that I want to have done in the morning, and then I'll come home if I've done that number of words, and I'll go over them at home in the afternoon to make sure that they read all right. Because somebody once told me a long, long time ago, don't get it right, get it written. And so the first time you put something down on paper, you sort of splurge it out. I think in America, sometimes they call it the vomit draft. And then you go over it and try and get it to the best shape you can. But then, of course, there are editors who come in and look at it when the first manuscript's finished. But that's basically the day. And I'm relatively old, so I've got grandchildren, so that takes up a fair bit of my time as well.
Talk me through you having to revise, as you say, the vomit draft. Yes. In the afternoon. How much work do you tend to do on that? And then what do you leave for your editors to do?
Well, I mean, I'll work on it to make it read as good as it can in the afternoon. But then when the whole manuscript is done, then I'll go over it again and again and again. So it's almost in the best shape that I can do. Then I'll send it to an editor. I particularly used an editor from a consultancy company. And with the first novel, he virtually tore it to shreds. But he loved the style, and he loved the writing, and he loved the dialogue, which was hopefully what I can do, because I'm a scriptwriter by trade. But there were certain things and it wasn't the structure, it was certain things that were sort of wrong with it in the way I'd approached it, which seemed like it was very damning, but actually was also very easy to fix. Because it was meant to be written in the first person by a young guy looking back when he was a very naive young lawyer, I tried to be clever and kept talking about ways he would suggest, well, I'm not really a writer, and he'd start off the first line, I think, which I loved all the time, and that was what gave me the idea to the book, was, I don't do scenery, which was his way of saying, you're not going to get lovely, you know, descriptions, which probably is true of me as well in a sense. But then the editor said quite rightly, this was just too knowing. You don't have to pretend. When you're somebody writing in the first person of the book, you sort of accept that the person can write. He doesn't have to apologise for not being a novelist, but being the person who he's meant to be. So I took a lot of that out, and I cut a lot of that, and just got to the bones of the story and the relationship. And it just worked much better. And I certainly don't miss those 8,000-10,000 words that I took out. I sort of set myself 1,000, 1,500 or 1,500 words, something like that. I started doing that when I was doing television comedy. I worked out that in an average half-hour episode, there are about 350 speeches. A speech is just when one person says something, then another person says something, that's another speech. And I worked out if there were 350 speeches and I did 70 a day, then by the end of a five-day week, I'd have the first draft of an episode. Then obviously I'd go over it, and the producers would go over it, but that's what I sort of set myself. I'm quite disciplined because I worked in advertising for 17 years, and you know, you didn't have the chance to just sit around and wait for the muse to strike. You had deadlines, and to start with, I was in advertising, and then bizarrely, I did actually write a short novel about a house that was haunted by a Jewish ghost, And I was working with a film director. He was doing some Heinz spaghetti commercials for me, but he was a film director called Nicholas Rogue, who directed things like Don't Look Now and The Witches and The Man Who Fell to Earth. And he loved it, and that was how I got into script writing. And I loved writing dialogue. I'd written a lot of sort of award-winning radio commercials. After that came probably the most successful one, which was called My Hero. Obviously, with scripts, they're very visual because you're working with cameras, and TV and film are visual media. Whereas when you're writing books, you have to create the pictures in the reader's head. So that's possibly the biggest difference. So you have to describe a lot more. You have to you can't allow for facial expressions. You know, everything has to be, in a sense, down there. But I do a lot of radio plays. So I'm used to actually painting pictures in people's heads. And people, when they've read my books, have said they're very visual, for obvious reasons.
So doing a lot of commercials and now, I guess, radio plays, but mainly the commercials.
And TV.
You've got to get a lot away very quickly. It's got to be very tight. It's got to be very concise. How do you think that has influenced now your writing as a novelist to make sure that it's not baggy and that you are economical with your words?
That's a brilliant question, actually, because people have said when they've read my books that they're very tight and very economical. And I think you're exactly right. It's because when you're writing TV commercials, you've got 30 seconds and you have to tell a story and you have to tell everything. So it's a wonderful, wonderful training. And even with television, you still have a finite length. You've got 30 minutes to tell a story. Books, I mean, a book can be anything from 150 pages to 1,000 pages. So in a sense, you have to impose that discipline on yourself.
Do you think that comes natural to you from your past?
Yes.
Did you have to work at it at the time?
No, interestingly, I think it's probably having a low attention span that actually I liked the shortness, the brevity of it, which is why I like 30-minute TV. I wouldn't be very good at, I think, long-running series. You know, I couldn't write 13-hour-long episodes. All my TV has been family stuff. I like writing things that people of all ages can watch. Aside from anything else, it's actually harder. Because there are certain areas which you can't go into, there's certain language you can't use, there's certain concepts you've got to float around. You can be adult in, you know, in the ideas sometimes, but not necessarily so much in the way that they're expressed. You know, although one doesn't necessarily get credit for this, I mean, I personally think it's harder to be clean and family oriented and really funny, because you've got to work with less, in a sense.
Niche technicalities of it. Are you writing to spec with My Hero, or like, do the BBC know who you are and say, Paul, we want you to write a prime time BBC tea time comedy?
I wish it worked like that. You know, it's so strange. You have a big series like May to December was BAFTA nominated, ran for 6 years, then So Haunt Me ran for a few years, and still you go back to square one and you're only as good as your next idea. So I wrote My Hero on spec, and bizarrely, I went to the BBC and the head and a particular executive really liked it. Then we went to the head of comedy at the time, and he said, well, I really like it aside from the superhero elements. And I thought, well, what else is there? It was the daftest thing I'd ever heard said. So I went away with my tail between my legs. But then I showed it to a director who was a friend of mine who directed So Haunt Me, and he loved it. And he showed it to the head of comedy at the BBC, and he had produced Father Ted. And he said, I think Ardal O'Hanlon, who played Father Dougal in Father Ted, would love this. He's been looking for a new comedy and he hasn't found anything he likes, so I'll try this. And it went to Ardal, and Ardal said, oh, this is the first comedy I've been able to see in my head since Father Ted. I really want to do this. And because we had Ardal, then they could give me the money to write the series. But until then, it was, you know, I was doing it on spec, and I'm still writing on spec.
Now, this is quite a touchy question, and it's not in any way how I feel about this. But I know that tea time comedies like that on BBC One that are quite broad, that are shot in front of an audience, can be quite lampooned and derided in kind of comedy elites. How do you feel about that?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, you say tea time, they're 8:30, so I suppose it's pre-watershed. I mean, they're not, you know, so early, because they're not in children's TV time. Oh, yeah, I remember with my family, one of the reviews that I remember, I wasn't involved in My Family, but I had friends who were, and it ran for years, and one of the reviews, I think, in one of the newspapers was inexplicably popular. I would think, well, it's not inexplicable, it's popular because people are enjoying it and watching it. You do get fed up because you know you're not going to be talked about at dinner parties. You know, it's not Fleabag, and it's not Catastrophe, and it's not one of those ones. And you probably aren't going to be in the first in line when the awards come out. So in that sense, but you know you're going to get a vastly bigger audience than any of those comedies have. I mean, when Made in December came out, we had about 13, 14 million people. I mean, when My Hero was out, it was 6 or 7 or 8 million. So actually, I'm sort of writing for the people out there.
We will get more from Paul A. Mendelsohn in just a tick. Now, if you're a bit of a fiend for a rom-com, right, and if you love a good whimper over an Audrey Hepburn movie, well, stay right there. You can find out the secrets behind one of your favourite films next.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Now, I think our podcast, Writer's Routine, it's good for a few things in my mind. Not only do you get tips and tricks from successful authors who have been there, who have done it, and they can give you advice for getting your own book that's knocking around your head, you know, out, through your arm, down onto paper, fingers crossed, publish as well. Also, the show is very good at helping me learn about internet things, because I've been busy recently making a website for the show. And I think it's already, you know, there's still a few bits to clean and gloss, a few I's to dot, a few T's to cross, and a few widgets to embed in there as well. But if you get online, you can have a nice look for yourself. It is writersroutine.com. On there, you can get in touch with the show, so you can give me any thoughts for writers that you would like to hear, questions you'd like me to ask them as well. Any opinions you've really got about the show are good. I might not read them out, but it's nice that you're there. Also, we've got links, so you can subscribe to the show, download them through any means that you fancy. All the podcast providers are there, and also you can listen back to all our old episodes as well. I've spent some time on it. It would be really good if you had a look. It is writersroutine.com. Now then, today's distinguished diary, it features the weird and wonderful writing routine of dare I say it, quite a weird and definitely wonderful writer. It's Truman Capote. Now, Capote is known for Breakfast at Tiffany's. He wrote the novella that inspired the huge, one of the 20th century's biggest films, and also his true crime documentary, but also kind of fiction book In Cold Blood, which detailed a series of real life murders in Kansas. And he was quite an eccentric man too. His routine was absolutely individual, right? He told the Paris Review in 1957, it's a great phrase, he was a horizontal author. And he couldn't think unless he was lying down. Do you ever think that you should be a horizontal worker at times? You know, you can't really be bothered to get up and go to work today. Boss, it's fine, I'm working horizontally today. So yeah, he did all of his stuff lying down, on a couch or in bed. And that he'd always need a cigarette as well and a coffee handy. Apparently he would puff and sip while he worked. He wrote for around 4 hours each day. That's all. Revising the work in the late evening, he wrote first off by longhand in pencil, then he moved this onto a typewriter. And you know I said how he worked horizontally? Well, he did the typing in bed as well. He would balance a pretty weighty metal typewriter on his knees. And that coffee in the morning, yeah, that would move into sherry and then martinis gradually through the day. The real interesting thing, though, about his writing routine was the superstitions that he believed in that helped his success. Get this. He wouldn't allow 3 finished cigarettes in the same ashtray. Only 3 butts were allowed in there, and he couldn't begin or end any work on a Friday. It's a bit of an excuse, that, isn't it, to give yourself a day off, I think, if you're going to finish on the Friday. No, stop. Oh, I must need 3 more days. I can only finish this on a Monday. He was also strange with numbers as well. He wouldn't dial a telephone number or book a hotel room if he had added the digits up in his brain and it came up with an unlucky number. Again, it's very precious of Truman. I'm not staying in this hotel room today, no. It's room 12. 1 and 2, that makes 13. I simply cannot be here. Yeah, it's kind of an excuse only to stay in the best possible rooms available. So, yeah, Truman was odd with numbers, but he was fantastic with words, and it helped him write some of the 20th century's most revered books. Right, it's time to get back then with my chat with Paul A. Mendelsohn, the scriptwriter turned author. He's got 2 books out at the moment, so we'll talk about the difference and the curiosities between writing for different ages in a little bit. Also, he will tell us the secrets of making things funny. At the start of the year, you released your debut novel. Where did that come from?
Well, it's called In the Matter of Isabel, and it's inspired by a case that I handled when I was a lawyer. And it was a custody case involving a foreign national. I won't go into the details, and the book is fictional, though it was inspired by a particular relationship, in a sense. And I'd always wanted to write this story. It was interesting that a woman who was considerably older than myself relied on me, who was knew nothing about family law, almost straight out of university, to win her child back. And I thought that was an interesting relationship when the power was in the hands of a youngster, really, and this sophisticated older woman really didn't know what to do.
How much did you know about the book while you sat down to write it on the very first day?
Well, I knew that I had a structure because I'd worked very hard on the structure because, you know, when you're writing a film and you have a finite time, you do work very hard on the structure of a thing. And I knew that I had the dialogue because dialogue's my strength. But what I had to do was decide whose voice it was going to be in, because that's in a sense what the novel was about, what a novel is about. It has to have a voice, and I chose to have it narrated by my hero, the young lawyer, but 12 years on, looking back at how he is now and how he was then, and really quite embarrassed by how he was then, because he took terrible in the book. He took terrible advantage of the client and was more interested in her because she was gorgeous rather than in the case, although he does get more involved in the case as time goes on.
What was the most surprisingly difficult element of writing a novel from someone with a background in extensive screenplay writing and actually having to crack out 100,000 words in one form?
I think it's that. I think what the hardest thing is I was trying to write the book, and then I kept getting diverted because I had to make a living, and I had the, you know, there were other things that I was writing, maybe radio or sort of TV development or something like that. And so I had to go away from the book and then come back to it and try and still get in the zone. But I'll tell you a good trick, and I'm, you know, this isn't original to me. I think probably most writers do this. If you know where you're going to be at the end of the day, if you know what the last scene is, don't finish it, or don't finish the chapter, so that when you come back the next day, it's easier because you're not starting a fresh chapter, you're not starting a fresh scene, you're just completing the scene or the chapter that you'd left halfway through the day before. And that's a much easier thing because that's already in your head. I think for me, because I'm a scriptwriter, I quite like to read some of the stuff out aloud, because to me it's about rhythm. It's about how it's that, you know, when a sentence is right or wrong, or a piece of dialogue is right or wrong. For me, if you hear it out loud, and you can hear, does it flow? And then sometimes you'll change a word, you'll put a word in another place, just because it's like, I like music, but I'm not musical. But I imagine it's the same sort of thing. You know when a tune is right, and or when there's a beat too many or a beat too few. In a sense, you instinctively know, or you think you know, that it's funny. But until somebody else reads it, or you work with somebody else, you're not totally sure. And I think it's often interesting that sometimes when I've seen this, when comedy writers have had some fantastic successes, they sometimes think that they know what's funny, so they don't allow other people into the mix, like script editors or directors. They virtually say, I know this is funny. And often the later work is not as good as their early work when they had a lot of editing. So I think you're never that good that you can't actually, it can't actually be made better by somebody else, somebody you respect. I mean, I would never take a note or do something that I didn't agree with, but I know there are people out there who can make my work an awful lot better than it is.
Talk to me about the decision now to write a children's book. It's Losing Arthur. When was the first moment that this story crept into your mind?
Well, the thing that got me into this business, I think I mentioned about Nicholas Rogue directing a spaghetti commercial years ago. The spaghetti commercial was about a little girl who has an imaginary friend called Eric. And Eric only turns up when there's Heinz spaghetti. It was a lovely little commercial. They were Geordie family. And they were actually the first sitcoms I wrote. They were little 30-second sitcoms. And I'd always liked the idea of imaginary friends. And I hadn't seen it done that much. And it just seemed so interesting. I didn't set out to write a children's book, because I don't regard myself particularly as a children's book writer. The story comes first and the idea. And if I've had an idea, then the idea tells me who it's aimed at. So when I think that there's a young lad who has an imaginary friend called Arthur, and his mother, who's a single mother, gets so fed up with this relationship that she grabs this piece of nothing and puts it in a box and posts it to his father in Scotland just to get rid of it, then that obviously lends itself to being a book that children will enjoy.
So you've got this idea, the very initial idea in your head.
Yeah.
Then what do you do? What do you do before you start writing it? Are you plotting it at all?
Plotted it all out.
Talk to me about that. How extensively are you doing that?
I think I'd plotted it the way I would plot a film. You know, I think in terms of scenes, and I think in terms of structure, and I think how would, you know, a lot of things happen. Like, it's first of all, it's in Hackney, then it's in Scotland, then the little boy is trying to is going. He leaps on a train to Manchester because he gets on the wrong train because he's running away from his sister who's been supposed to be looking after him. And so I've sort of plotted the logic, and I wanted just to be over a weekend because it gives it a sort of intensity and a structure that it happens on Friday and it's all sorted out by Sunday, but with lots of adventures. And so I think very careful plotting, because I couldn't, but sometimes you don't quite know where something is going to go. If I plot too religiously, First of all, plotting is not the most creative exercise compared to writing. And if I plot too religiously, it sort of stifles you. I think the creativity comes from somewhere inside yourself that you just have to trust.
So you've got this, you've decided that it's for kids. How are you then making sure that it appeals to kids and that they get it and felt like they've been talking to?
Because I'm a writer, I don't think about going down to another level of understanding. I think that comes naturally. I know that I can't particularly use certain words, and concepts have to be a bit simpler, and I've got to make it exciting and funny. But I'm not saying children's writers talk down to the audience, because obviously the good ones don't. But I just regard them as adults who maybe don't have the same experience as some of the other adults.
You are right. Good children's writers, they don't talk down or pander or patronise, but they do realise that there are certain things that children like, and there are reasons why adult novels can be too long, too exhaustive, with fairly lengthy sentences that just it won't appeal to kids.
Exactly.
How much did you keep that in your mind as in the style of the prose while you were writing?
Again, reading it in my head, you know, talking it, listening to it in my head, I realised that I had to temper it a bit, and some of the structures had to be a little bit simpler, and also keep it moving. I mean, you're not going to have a lot of scenes where people discuss the state of the world or you know, it was action, and they're leaping on trains and getting thrown out of cars, and there's lots of monsters of sorts, and so I think of that. But also, because I tend to think visually, because it's my training, then it was just making it seem visual on the page.
Are you back to writing in adult fiction now?
Yes, I'm writing an adult novel.
How has it been reverting back to adults from after writing for kids?
Well, the kids one, although it came out, the kids one I wrote before the adult one. So I wrote that before in The Matter of Isabel.
Well, then, how has it been writing a novel which isn't inspired by something that happened in real life? Or is it your newest one?
Well, it sort of is. My wife and I went on honeymoon to a particular place and then went back 25 years later to the same place. And I said, wouldn't it be fun if we met our honeymooning selves there? And that was the inspiration for this particular thing. I won't go into too much detail because it's not really worked out yet. But I'm enjoying doing it. But I'm also trying to do some TV comedy as well at the moment.
You're flitting between novels and screenplays.
Yeah, I'm flitting between the things we've got with myself and a writing partner, because I do sometimes write with another person, which is fantastic, which is so much more fun.
So that is it then for this week's episode of Writer's Routine. Thank you so much to Paul A. Mendelsohn for coming over and having a chat with me. His books, Losing Arthur and In the Manner of Isabel, they're out right now. And if you do fancy buying them, we've got handy links on the website. It's writersroutine.com. And who knows, then you can chuck a few more quid in his piggy bank, which inevitably goes towards buying cappuccinos at the Costa Coffee in Pinner. I got confirmation of a huge guest for the Writer's Routine, actually, the other day. One of the biggest writers in the country. I don't really want to say their name just yet, though. You know, I don't want to speak too soon, don't want to count my chickens, so just please do take my word for this. One of the biggest writers in the country, fingers crossed, will be on this show soon. So yeah, tell all the aspiring authors and creatives that you know, because they will want to hear the tips and the secrets of creative working that this guy hopefully will have to share. And remember, you can hear all the old episodes of Writer's Routine on our website. It's writersroutine.com. Make sure you subscribe and download the episodes as well through iTunes. While you're there, leave us a handy review. Please give us 5 stars as well. That would be very helpful. You can follow us on Twitter as well. We are at writerspod. The email is writersroutine@gmail.com. And that's about it. We'll see you next week with another episode of Writer's Routine.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays.
Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.